Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
Hello, Chicago!
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with Black Thought of the Roots about his book, The Upcycled Self. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, let's review new music from another rapper, Heems. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island since 1988. Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find 312 Weed Ale, Big Juicy Beer Hug, and so many other limited releases at either of Goose's locations in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
You already know. Hey, yo, I'm pretty cool, yo. Everybody love me. Not Hindu thuggy from Queens where my thugs be. In the polo rugby, I Tokyo drift my buggy. I've been an OG since mama caught me huggies.
That is a little bit of I'm Pretty Cool from the new Heems record, Laughender. Heems, we might recognize that name from a group that we have reviewed on the show a decade ago. Das Racist. That's racist, man. They conflated that to Das Racist, D-A-S, yeah. Racist. As you can tell from the name of that group, they have a tongue-in-cheek attitude towards a lot of things in the world. That is very typical of Das Racist and also of Heems' discography. Heems, born Himanshu Suri, of Indian heritage, grew up in Queens, New York, formed Das Racist with Kool-Aid D, a friend from college. Went to Wesleyan. They both went to Wesleyan University in Connecticut. And this kind of novelty single combination, Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, yeah. In 2008, really took off. It was just a weird little sidelight. Very funny, very satirical.
Hi, I'm at the Pizza Hut.
What?
Combo of two mixtapes in 2010, Shut Up Dude and Sit Down Man. Again, much acclaim, a little bit of controversy. They were not politically correct all the time, but they were also speaking out about being brown people in the world and what that meant. Relax was the first LP in 2011. They got a major label deal with Sony Records and then broke up.
Yeah.
They never quite got around to finishing up that Sony record. A lot of people were disappointed. Heems went on to have start a solo career. He had an album come out in 2015 as a solo artist. He also worked with a group called Sweatshop Boys, put out an album in 2016, sandwiched around a couple of EPs. And then we didn't hear from Heems for about 6 years. He was doing other projects. He's in demand in a lot of multimedia areas.
Yeah, well, and he started an indie label.
Yeah, he did indeed. But he's back now with Laughender. That's Hindi slang for someone who is considered worthless.
L-A-F-A-N-D-A-R.
That's right. We're going to play a track from it. It's called Accent on Sound Opinions.
How many likes will my hate crime receive? How many times will they hate crimes deceive? It's easier to make a meme than to have a dream. Because to Heems, it just seems that they deem is a scheme. Can you flee when they treat you like dogs with the fleas? You say please, but they beat you like dogs with disease. And the glands dried up and you're out of tears. And your visa ran out, so you're out of years. And how does my accent sound when I'm crying? How does my accent sound when I'm dying?
That is a little bit of Accent from the new album by Heems, Laughender. Greg, we bumped in with I'm Pretty Cool. And indeed, Heems is. I think he has made history. History, my Polish friend. I'm only one quarter Kopaczynski. I can't think of any other song in the history of popular music that mentions kielbasa.
Yeah.
He's eaten kielbasa and pasta. Heems is very funny. Some of his references on this album are a little old. He's dropping Ich mein Berliner, yeah. Kennedy's famous statement, and Murder, She Wrote, and Star Trek. This is the album where he reminds us what a fluid, funny, sharp, insightful rapper he is. He has said that the goal for this record is he wanted to be all about the flow, to be all about the rapping. And he is, the rhymes are just wonderful. There's one after another, mm-hmm. And then to pair it with this incredible musical backdrop by a Chicago-based producer, Lapgan, with Indian and world beat rhythms and sounds. It's really, really inventive. Because of his work with Das Racist, a lot of people wrote him off as an alternative rapper, mm. which in many quarters of the hip-hop world, I couldn't disagree more, mm. whether we go back to ancient history, De La Soul, or the present, I think it should be a compliment. You are breaking new ground and coloring outside the lines, bringing in unexpected musical samples and lyrical diatribes, right? I mean, it's just like, this guy is incredibly, incredibly creative, and this album is just a beginning to end joy.
Yeah, I agree completely. Heems is one of a kind, and he still is. He's dropped, as you mentioned, like name drops all over the place, both from his Indian heritage and from his New York City upbringing, city he knows very well. New York City meets India, as he raps in that one line, I'm an urban legend.
Yo, I'm an urban legend, an Hermes turban legend, Prada loafers at my cousin's wedding.
Right. And I mean, as you said, every line almost seems to contain these little laugh lines, as well as incredible insight. There's a lot of whimsy here, a lot of wordplay. As word guys, as you and I are, we appreciate that sort of
After
stuff.
Kielbasa, quoting Dr. McCoy from Star Trek, damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor, not a physician.
Exactly. And, in a track like I'm Pretty Cool, he's celebrating that macho boasting, but he's also satirizing it.
He can laugh at himself.
Macho cliches, right? He can get serious. Accent, the track we just played a little bit of. How does my accent sound when I'm dying?
Yeah.
Yellow chakra, I tell my people how this census affects us. Life is precious. The government neglects us. He's bringing in these kind of political themes into the music. But above all, he is just full of life and color and humor. And humor is a thing that I think is lacking in a lot of contemporary hip-hop.
Yeah.
You used to hear that a lot back in the day. Guys, just the joyousness of being a hip-hop artist. But you're right. Lapgan is the hero of this record. A lot of those South Asian, West Asian folk, British post-punk,
definitely sitar,
complimenting Heems' flow. You've got the freeform Heems, but then you've got this amazing, as you said, backdrop. I dove into Lapgan's history. He's got a bunch of great instrumental records out there. I highly recommend his 2023 release, History. Mm. So Lapgan is the real find here in terms of just bringing him to a wider audience.
Well, that's what we thought of the new album by Heems. Now we want to hear your thoughts. Are you a fan of Heems, of Das Racist? Is he still delivering this rapper? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. When we come back, we're going to talk to, no exaggeration, a hip-hop legend, Black Thought. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in and inspired by Chicago. They got 312 Wheat Ale, Hazy Beer Hug, and many more one-off beers at the Fulton Street Tap Room or their new Salt Shed Pub. the perfect place to go before a show at the Salt Shed. Me and Andrew were there on opening night, Greg. Mm-hmm. It was really exciting. You had Rocky Mountain spotted fever, tick fever. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, every time we go to one of these goose joints, there's another new one to try, and we love them all.
I'm a fan. In addition to making great products and event spaces, Goose Island has always been a supporter of music culture in Chicago and nationwide. I mean, if you see that Goose Island logo at a venue or a restaurant, you know you're in good hands.
Yeah, we are proud to be associated with Goose Island. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And Sound Opinions is. Sound Opinions is brought to you by NordVPN. NordVPN is the gateway to secure and private access to the internet. We all need that. And it works by enveloping all of your online activities in a layer of encryption while also hiding information about your virtual location. Greg, before I had a VPN, I was sitting in a doctor's waiting room, and boy, did I get hammered with a virus. I mean, I'd go to the doctor and get rid of a virus.
Well, safety from viruses is one of the great uses of NordVPN. It's an incredible tool. It's easy to use. You can connect with just one click and enjoy the amazing speed on every major platform, from Windows to iOS to Android. Now, this summer, I'll be doing some traveling.
You're going overseas.
This is a necessity. You know, you've got to use this. I know I can count on NordVPN to help me easily access secure connections on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere I go. You know, it's easy to get hacked these days, right?
Yep.
This will help. It also makes it easy to access paid subscriptions to streaming services and content, even if it's not available in the country I'm in.
So you can watch your Netflix while you're sunning it in Europe.
Absolutely.
If you want safe access to your favorite streams, social media, and more, no matter where you are, get an exclusive NordVPN deal here at nordvpn.com/soundopinions. nordvpn.com/soundopinions. It's risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee, and the link's in the description of this episode. And we are back. This week, we're talking with an artist we've admired for decades, Black Thought of the Roots, known to his mom as Tariq Trotter. While many music fans first heard the Roots in the late 90s, Tariq and Amir Questlove Thompson have been making music together since 1987. For the past 15 years, the Roots, you may know, have been the house band for Jimmy Fallon's late night talk show. But they are always stretching out and always trying new creative projects.
That's absolutely right, Jim. Questlove's directing Oscar-winning movies these days, and now Black Thought has written an incredible memoir, The Upcycled Self. No exaggeration, one of the best music memoirs we've ever read. We caught up with him while he was in his dressing room at 30 Rock a few weeks ago. Tariq, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Jim and I have been raving about this book for weeks since we've read it, and I'm blown away by the level of intensity and passion. Tariq, I think people generally don't know a lot about you as a person. I mean, they're
right.
in love with what you do as an artist and as a hip-hop MC, but, you know, the life story that you're telling here is pretty intense, pretty deep. Very detailed. You clearly have a sharp memory for everything that happened to you and influenced you. Why did you decide to go to this level? I mean, we're talking about several levels deep now in your life.
A huge part of it is because, I have, fans who have supported me for, at this point, decades, many of whom, have that same feeling of, why there's just not much I know about this artist. And that is, that's been by design. Because I'm just super guarded, and I'm a fiercely private person, and I think that's all also attributable to my introversion, right? So that said, I have my own things, right? You read my book, you get to take in some of my lived experience, you'll come to realize that I have my own things, that I'm still working through in life. There's much that I grapple with, from day to day. And I think there's value in the fact that, where we place celebrity, the value that we place on fame and on famous people, and the level of influence, right? I think it's something that is very real, and I think along with that and because of that, comes a responsibility. So I felt almost a responsibility to give more entree into my story and into, you know, that from which I came because of the value that it could possibly hold for other folks who might, you know, see themselves, or see, even a fraction of themselves reflected in my story, right? We all, are looking for that representation. So if I'm able to serve as that representation for anyone, then, it was definitely, that's one of the things that would make this experience worthwhile. But aside from that, it's just it's been therapeutic. This has been my therapy to sort of peel back those layers of the onion. That's, it's been cathartic for me in that way. So
I want to ask about that philosophy, Tariq. You write, "Our lives are a response to the call of our childhood. Somewhere in the echoes of the past, we find our truest selves. What if we chased the threads running through the quilted patterns of our lives and pulled them? What if we trusted the upcycle?" So that's yeah. Many people may not know why the book is titled The Upcycled Self. Explain yeah. that concept to me of upcycling.
I mean, the concept of upcycling is, doing away with a thing that, no longer serves you, or, taking a thing, finding a thing, discovering, something in its original state and adding value to it, making it better. It goes back to what folks say about, you leave people, places, things better than you found them. That essentially is the upcycle, but it's applying that principle to one's self, and it's about, a level of fearlessness, the level of fearlessness that is required to, to show vulnerability, right? To show the chinks in the armor, especially in this culture, because of just what it's been built upon. It's always been in hip hop. It's been about, building oneself up to be something larger than life. What I'm saying? It's about, winner takes all. I'm a superhero. I walk on water. I do all this stuff.
Yeah, I got the Benjamins. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. But I think there's something in there's true value in humanizing humanizing celebrity in that way. And into making, ourselves relatable, into making our stories accessible. You know what I'm saying? And I'm mm-hmm. at a point in my career, and really just in my life, where I get the most joy out of being of service, to mm-hmm. just to folks, to yeah. friends, family, strangers. I think that's a beautiful thing. So if I'm able to, somehow be of service and still keep creative, because I'm an artist at my core too, so it's not like I'll ever stop making or creating things. So as long as there's a new medium, for me to mm-hmm. engage in, or even once I run out of mediums, I think this is something that I'll continue to do. So I think all of that sort of informs the why of it all. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I think yeah, in terms of the upcycle, I asked myself, if not now, then when? And, why not now? Yeah. So it was, and it, I don't know, man. I felt like I try and make myself receptive of that call whenever it comes, from yeah. the universe, from the ancestors, from within oneself, the call to action, to do a thing, in the way to best observe, the way to best receive that call is to just open yourself up. Mm-hmm. So I made myself, this isn't, I still don't feel, I feel like this is just the tip of the iceberg, in that there's so much, I've lived so much more life, the point at which the story sort of, where you're left off, it's still early on, in the roots career and it's early on in this whole dynamic. And, you know, there's much more evolution to do.
Yeah.
But again,
no,
I mean,
it's not a musician memoir. It's a life story.
Yeah, it is.
And so we were chasing you for a couple of weeks before everybody's schedule jibed. And I've heard you do a couple of other interviews, right? And everybody asks you the same thing about the book Starting with the Fire. You know, as a boy, you burned down the family house. And I'm thinking,
by accident, we should
by accident, by accident.
Right,
by,
right. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't arson.
No, I'm getting there. You know, and you were playing with green little plastic army men. And yeah, I did that. Yeah. I was more ambitious. I built the 1/35th scale tanks, right? And my brother would take them and put a firecracker in them and blow them up.
Yeah.
And you guys were doing, you know, it's war, right? So you're playing with the lighter, the army man catches fire, it jumps to the rug, the house, and I'm thinking, that could have been me. Mm-hmm. That could have been great.
Absolutely.
We all did that.
Yeah, I was no unicorn in that. We all had those army men, and they came in, you know, a pack. Right.
They still sell them.
And they were
so,
and, you know, all they would do, they were figurines. So they would stand on a little stand, and, you know, we had imagination. So you had to, if you wanted any, to add any realism to it, then you had to, you know, like disfigure and, you know, like saw parts off. And
they got thrown in the pool or the sink. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah,
and, you know, like before the days of flame retardant, you know, carpeting and, you know, child safe lighters. It was just the perfect storm.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I was
in no way, shape, or form you know, like a young arson. Arsonist, or and I was, you know, I wasn't like fascinated by fire in that way, but I was just a curious kid, you know. And I think there's the beauty in, you know, part of the beauty in that experience was the grace that my mother was able to extend and her wisdom in recognizing that curiosity, that, you know, as my imagination and being able to sort of embrace it and encourage me to lean into it. As a young person, you know.
Well, your relationship with your mother, Cassie, and your grandmother, Minnie, are central to the book.
Yes.
And you were basically raised by these two women, which to me is an extraordinary gift that they gave you, but you in turn give them the gift back by recognizing what they did for you in this book. And it's an important part of your story. If they hadn't been there, how would you have turned out, right?
Right.
You know, the circumstances surrounding your childhood were just devastating in a lot of ways. The drug use that was around you, the crime that was around you. You could have easily fallen down that trap, right?
Yeah, the Reagan
step away from that
crack epidemic, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was, you know, the fact that you were that close, I mean, did you feel like at some point you could have tripped into that, into a totally different life than what you have right now?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I was, you know, I was in it. It was the norm. It was the standard, right? You know, everyone from, you know, where I was from at the time that, you know, I was sort of growing up, when I was a teenager, the crack epidemic hit, and, you know, almost everyone was either smoking it or, you know, you were either using it or selling it, you know? And it was... I mean, you know, kids, I would see, you know, kids who were 12 and 13 and 14 years old in a matter of weeks go from kid to kingpin, you know, and that was the reality. You know, you saw kids who weren't old enough to have a driver's license, who had multiple, you know, Mercedes and BMWs and that whole thing. And so, yeah, it was there was a status associated with it. That I think, you know, before, I think at its onset, no one knew, you know, the how dangerous it was going to be, right? And I mean, no one knew, you know, how it was going to play out until it sort of played out. But once we were sort of in it, my future looked and felt, you know, very bleak at the time, just because all I had to go off of was you know, the example that had been set by you know, friends and family. And, you know, folk, I talk about how as a kid, you know, sometimes I was asked, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? Or, you know, where do you see yourself at the age of, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years old? And I would always be hard pressed to, you know, to extract that example from the ether, because there were about two generations that had been lost. So I knew when I was a kid, I knew people who were, you know, in their 60s and 70s. I knew, like, you know, grandparents, but, you know, people who were, you know, my mother's age and maybe, you know, slightly older than my mother, you know, were the generation that, you know, had been lost to the epidemic.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, it coincides with that story. Your life was saved not only by these two women, but by hip hop. You're the same age as hip hop.
Yeah.
An incredible, you know, confluence of events. But that seemed to be, as a young artist, what do I do? Here's an art form that presents all the possibilities.
Right.
It wasn't just music, but it was all this culture that was around it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What was your first experience with that?
My first experience, you know, with him, I don't know. You know, I think it's hard for me to pinpoint a time at which, you know, it sort of all began, right? Because hip hop and I began essentially together. And at a time when there was no one had a laser focus. There wasn't like, you know, this is what I major in, or this is what, you know, I focus the most in hip hop. It was like we were all hip hoppers, which meant we had to embrace the culture in its entirety. And, you know, you had to dance and you had to do, you know, graffiti, and you had to, you know, you try to DJ and the human beatbox and you rapping and all of the things that sort of came with the culture were embraced, or I don't just all at once. You know, I mean, they just came. It was it's all I've ever known, you know. But in that, I, you know, as a kid, I remember feeling as if I had a voice, you know. The first time I remember seeing that representation where I felt there was someone who, you know, looked and looked like I did and, you know, came from a place like I was from and who was, you know, articulating themselves, you know, in a way that I'd aspired to sort of, you know, a voice for the voiceless of it all was, I mean, really with Run DMC. You know, you know, for me, I was into hip hop, and I definitely, the stories of Melly Mel on The Message. And
don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Curtis Blow, and you know what I mean, the first, you know, rap stars, all of their music really resonated with me. Sugar Hill Gang, I rock with them. You know, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and all those old school groups. But that was still during a time when they were, they just looked like the funk bands, right? Which was so far out. Like, there was nobody walking down the street around my way who looked like, you know, Rick James, you know what I mean?
Run DMC because, dressed like you and your
friends. Exactly. Yeah. Run DMC was the first time I saw, wow, like, that's someone who looks like they came off my street. You know what I mean? And they were up there and they were telling stories that were comparable to my stories. So that's when I first felt, you know, that representation was in Run DMC. And that was, you know, probably 1983. So I was about 10 years old.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Perfect timing, right?
So you wrote your first rap at 9. And you make your first recording when you are at Philly's Kappa, you know, the High School for Creative and Performing Arts. After you meet this guy, you're in there for trouble in the principal's office, and he's not, right? He's in there, you know, because that's not his way. I'm going to put you on the spot, Tariq. Partners in Rhyme, P.I.R., Partners in Rhyme. Yeah. First track you and Amir record together.
Yes.
Give us a few bars, man.
Oh, man. Well, it starts, it goes, P.I.R., here we are, partners in rhyme, not crime, and we're bound to go far. My rhyme drive is live. I'm too hyped to be a mellow fellow. Do I play on a cello? Hell no. Intro in full stereo. My scenario. And now it goes on. You know, you know, the harsh reality of that, that song is that demo serves as a reminder of, you know, just the business, in that there was a, you know, a grown man who had this recording studio who allowed these kids to come in and work on stuff, knowing that we weren't gonna, you know, likely finish, you know, maybe ever. But, you know, spending our money, $50 an hour in the 80s, when 50 bucks was 50 bucks.
Yeah.
And that was just, you know, and we can't blame him. It was, you know, it was, he was doing his job, we were doing ours. And it was, you know, that was the point at which, you know, we began to learn, you know, the proverbial lesson, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, and then also partner, you know, another memory associated with Partners in Rhyme, which I talk about in the book, is that was the demo that was the cassette that was inside my boom box when it was stolen by a guy, you know, one of the guys in my neighborhood. And, you know, there was a whole thing about, you know, I had to go through to try and get the boom box back. But yeah, that was PIR. That was that first demo.
Oh, I was reading that and I was like, I got to ask, you know, either that's going to go spectacular or he's going to be like, who the hell are you? Right. you write of your relationship with Amir. He's a kid literally locked in his basement. His parents lock him in, make him rehearse, you know, 12 hours a day.
Well, they keep him out of the neighborhood,
keep
right?
Him out, keep the neighborhood safe, out, you know? And keep him out of the neighborhood. Yeah. You know, and you guys form this bond. You begin making music together. You write, we offered a necessary level of escapism to each other. Can you talk about what you gave him, how you were escaping through him, and how he was escaping through you?
We were able to expose one another to sort of an element that was missing, right? I think as it applies to me, it was that stability that it was lost in the fire. It was the, you know, some of the innocence that he and his sister Dawn still had because they, you know, come up in a two-parent household, right? Like just that nuclear family representation that I, you know, I didn't have before the fire. Probably, you know, never would have had, but that, you know, some of what had been lost, I saw in the Thompsons. So there was that, and it was, you know, just their reality as, you know, I mean, no reality is perfect. No one's life is perfect, but it was different than mine, you know, so it appealed to me that it was just something that was different. So I'm going to go over there. I'm going to, you know, immerse myself in this thing, in their dynamic and soak it up because it was interesting and just, you know, cool to engage. And I think that was a two-way street, you know, and what appealed to Amir was, you know, all of the things that I had experienced and all the stuff that I knew about that he hadn't in his lived experience. So, you know, so it was that, you know, essentially. But what it boiled down to was a musical, you know, our romance was more musical in that Amir was familiar with all the music. He had grown up, you know, having to listen to and learn and play the music that, you know, I never even thought twice about. It was the sort of stuff that, you know, my uncle may put on jazz radio if I'm going, you know, to help him out at one of his jobs one day, but it would be painful for me, you know what I mean, until we reach our destination. So I think the beauty in it was that he was able to show me, you know, that from which my beloved hip-hop had come. Right. I was able to listen to hip hop. I could buy, you know, cassettes and stuff, you know, and take my music home. And nobody would even, you know, raise an eyebrow about what I brought into the house because they didn't care. I mean, my grandmother didn't care about what I was listening to in my Walkman. She had bigger fish to fry. But Amir wasn't allowed to listen to certain music. So there was a whole world that, you know, was opened up to, you know, both of us at the same time musically. In that, you know, he put me on to the origins of hip hop, the jazz and soul and funk origins of the music. And I put him on to, you know, the hip hop that he would never had been exposed to. The Public Enemy, N.W.A., you know what I mean? Really hardcore stuff at the time. And it's like, you know, it's wild that when we received this music, you know, these albums, you know, this artistic activism and social political commentary. We were like, you know, 9 and 10 and 11 years old, right? Listening to Black Steel and the Hour of Chaos, She Watches Channel Zero, Terminator X and the Edge of Panic. You know, the name of the Public Enemy's album was It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Yeah. It was just, you know, the jarring sort of thing that, yeah, I mean, if I were overly protective of my son and I was trying to, you know, keep them, you know, keep him on a specific trajectory of your music like that and those sort of titles and that, you know, I would try to, you know, shelter him from that stuff too.
There's this concept in sociology going back to my college years that every subculture needs a guide, right? Nobody grows up knowing how to smoke weed or how to be a member of a motorcycle gang. You are Dante, and you need to have Beatrice guide you on.
Wow.
So you were to Amir that guide through hip hop, and he was to you the whole rest of the history of music.
Yeah, that's
beautiful. Absolutely. Man.
We've always been able to see and appreciate the greater good and, you know, just the, you know, like the moral of it all, you know, and in this, you know, just I can't think of a better person to have, you know, tortoise in the haired this career with than my partner.
Well, 11 Lee. Roots albums, studio albums. Then your 3 solo records. Yeah.
Yo, I'm from another planet, though currently I'm stranded here, where I see people clearly taking every day for granted, where every time I lift my ship up off the ground, it's landed to my disadvantage, though maybe I am but a gambit and held to another standard.
When we come back, more of our conversation with Tariq Trotter, Black Thought. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. This has been my reality, maybe I'm schizophrenic. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, alotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. This week we're talking with Tariq Trotter, better known as Black Thought of the Roots. Let's get back to the conversation. How has your relationship with hip-hop evolved in those 50 years? Do you feel the same way about it now that you did when you were a 10-year-old kid? I mean, do you still have that energy and passion that you had then?
I do. I do still have that energy and passion, and I feel the same way about it in many ways as that I did, you know, as a kid. I think what hip-hop has become is, you know, hip-hop is all-encompassing. It has become, you know, it's this omnipotent, omnipresent sort of thing now.
The lack of acceptance for hip-hop for so long, I think, was a driving force in the creativity there.
Yeah.
And now it rules everything. So can it be as inspiring and creative, or is it just about commerce now? You know, that's what a lot of people on the outside looking in are saying, well, it's all driven by the mighty dollar, you know, and maybe it was always thus, but it seems more apparent now than ever because there's more money than ever going its way, flowing its way.
Yeah, I mean, if we went back in time and told those 2 10-year-old kids listening to records nonstop, you know, someday you're going to be on The Tonight Show, the paradigm of mainstream, not even on The Tonight Show, you know, running the Tonight Show's music. Yeah. You know, it's insane.
Yeah. I would have said you were insane, and Amir, yeah. You know, a 10-year-old Amir would have said, you know, absolutely. You know, I think he knew that was the case. Well, here's the thing. Yeah. This is how we differ. Yeah. You know, I burned down my house, you know, playing with Army Men at 6. And Amir played, he was a musical director for his family at Radio City Music Hall at 4. He's been very steadfast in his certainty, you know, throughout his entire trajectory. You know what I mean? I spent lots of time sort of trying to figure it out. You know what I mean? Am I going to be an artist? You know what I'm saying? A visual artist? You know, what discipline am I going to lean into? Should I become an accountant? You know what I mean? Yeah, I don't know. He's never, you know, waned in that way. He's always been, you know, and that's, you know, again, he had that, you know, that Joe Jackson-esque sort of, example, you know what I mean?
Driven.
Yeah.
For better or worse.
The other tragedy in the book besides the fire is the death of your mother. And I'm sorry to take you there, but you write about it so movingly. And you say, you know, I was delusional to think that it wasn't going to change me. It also made me part of who I am today.
Yeah. You know, grief, loss, you know, the tragedy of that magnitude affects people usually only in one of two ways, right? You're either going to move through life from that point on as the wounded, right? Or you're going to gain wisdom from it. And, you know, that wisdom is something that, you know, one acquires over time. You know, it's about recognizing trauma as trauma in order to really, you know, to take it head on and begin to do the work.
Well, and also that it's universal, because we come to know your mother, and then the violent end that she meets, we come to understand and empathize, I think, with how so many in the community lost loved ones or their own lives to this damn scourge of violence and drugs and the cycle of abuse, you know, on the streets of not only South Philly, but every great American city.
Absolutely.
That's your talent as a writer, Sharik. You know, I think you're right. It's like, okay, I was the artist doing graffiti and carrying around, you know, the other thing, Greg, I love, the telling detail. He said by his own art desk with 3 dozen X-Acto knives on it, is you're about to carry the X-Acto knife, which was a nice way to have a little backup in an emergency, right?
Dual purpose, right?
Yeah. So besides, you know, deciding, maybe I'm an artist, maybe I'm a rapper, you know, it's like, man, you got a career writing books. I wish I've written some sentences as beautiful as those in your memoir.
Oh, man. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, watch out. We're going to turn him into a novelist now, and he's not going to make any more hip-hop records. He's just going to write books.
There was also a record this year, though.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I know the book was finished before, but what a year, man. And in between, you have a day job that's kind of interesting. Like, jeez.
Right. Well, I got two questions about that day job. First of all, you guys were aiming high. You know, the fact that nobody really knew what to make of the Roots when they came out, I thought that was mind-blowing because, you know, they got live instruments. Are they a band? You know, this is unprecedented in hip hop. Nobody's doing this, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and are they playing jazz? What are they? And you know, so first question is, were you in Questlove of one mind when it came to this is what it's going to be? It's going to be something different, and it's going to be a little weird for some people, and maybe not accepted by everybody as true hip hop. So what was the mindset early on about that concept?
Yes, we thought all those things, like almost verbatim, you know, and we overthought those things. And, you know, we'd have, you know, discussions at length about, you know, ways to pivot if necessary. You know what I'm saying? And then, you know, we'd also discuss, you know, ways that we weren't willing, ways in which we weren't willing to compromise. And I think, you know, one of those ways in which we weren't willing to compromise was the musicality of our art. And, You know, so in that, we just had to be prepared to take on all challenges. So, we were always ready for someone to say, oh, you know, you suck as a drummer or you're not the best rapper. So we can rise to that challenge and sort of prove them wrong. I think that is something, that edge, that competitiveness is something that is very, hip hop, that has always been part of the Roots sort of, spiritual canon. But I think all of the other, so many other things, you know, other than hip hop. And I think that ambiguity, especially earlier on, it served as it worked in our favor because, as you say, people were like, are they a band? Do they play instruments? Are they going to do this? Are they going to do that? The answer was yes and to all of those questions, whatever you needed, whatever type of artist your venue catered to, whatever you needed, you know, in the studio, whatever, we would accept the gig and then figure out, you know, what we needed to do to rise to said challenge. We were able to, Jesse, y'all talk about how, you know, we are like hip hop and those parallels. The Roots has also, been able to serve as all things to all people in many regards. You know?
Yeah, more than just two turntables and a microphone. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you were like, you expanded the definition right away. And it made it easier for groups like Outkast, for example, to get accepted, I think, because they weren't doing things by the book either, right?
Yeah.
And they become selling millions of records. The other question I had, Tariq, was Black Thought. You call yourself Black Thought, and all of a sudden you're going, that's a big weight to put on your shoulders. Like, okay, that's... And early on in the book, I thought you offered a really interesting take on, who am I? A chorus replies, you are all of us. So it goes back to what you were saying earlier about service. Being of service to others. So was that kind of the idea early on for you? You know, it could have been interpreted multiple ways, but it sounds like that's what you were aiming for.
Early on, it was, earlier on, taking on the moniker was a nod to, just to my artistry, to, visual arts and, it was more literal, thinking in terms of palette and, Black. I think, Black Thought was singular, right? I was the Black Thought. You know what I'm saying? I was a Black Thought as opposed to Black Thought, which is, something that I've become, which is, more all encompassing. So, I think names like Black Thought, names like The Roots, are associated with, really destiny in a way that it was impossible for me to separate myself or this collective from them. We were supposed to be called The Roots. That's why, when we wanted the copyright Square Roots, the copyright was taken. And that's why, even though we were called Square Roots, if you look at, Organics, which was essentially our demo, but what people, respect as our first album, it just says The Roots on the cover. Mm. The first song on that album is The Roots Is Coming. But still, we weren't called The Roots yet, but it was, I think it spoke to something, greater that was, meant to be. And I think, there was The Roots was it's something that was it was had been written long before Amir and I met,
I ripped the vocal back, flip, yo, the kid is a bad bro. I could drip it, hip it, then dip into Calypso. Adios, amigo, which means I got Stigio. Makes you wonder about my number, guess my address or my P.O. is a hint. I'm from Villa with the dub, but not the Rio. Well, I'm guessing here is like exactly where the Vigo. Now, we got the Philadelphia, why not top it off?
So I think along with that comes, not to make it too heavy, but there is a certain amount of responsibility that comes along with knowing that, you're carrying out this thing that, right, you know what I'm saying, that means so much to so many different people and so many different things to so many different people and something that was, sort of meant to be. So that's what I embrace, you know what I'm saying? I have a friend, a poet named Amir Suleiman, and one of my favorite pieces from his, from him is a piece called, he talks about your ancestors, something about you are an the example that your ancestors set for you and how we all have to act accordingly. You know what I mean? Because the ancestors, because of their sacrifice and the fact that they're sort of still, here with us watching. So, you do yourself and your community and your ancestors a disservice in not embracing, your light to its fullest potential. But a poet named Amir Suleiman, who's a good friend of mine, he says, act accordingly. And I think that speaks to, just that responsibility,
I got a question for you, kind of a geeky music question too, about your shows. Most bands, most artists who go on stage, they play a song and then they play another song and then they play a song. And I've been to countless Root shows where I feel like it's just one endless stream of music. And yeah. it's just yeah. like it yeah. never stops. There's no chance yeah. to really applaud because you guys are just going and You're, going and
you,
going.
You get on and you yep. take the ride, yeah.
So my question yeah. Is that all planned out ahead of time, or are you literally improvising as you go along? Are there cues like, oh, we're going here now, we're going no. there next?
There's lots of cues. There isn't much improvisation that goes on in a regular Roots performance. It's all, you know, sequenced out and there's a set list. But yeah, I think we're conscious. The idea has always been for it to be a seamless, you know, experience. So, you know, any way that we're able to, you know, connect the dots, then, you know, that's sort of what we do. And, me as a vocalist, I just have reached a point where I'm able to rock out for long, extended periods of time. You know, sometimes I'll come out, I'll sing just straight for the first 45 minutes of a set and then I'll get a break. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And there's something in the energetic, like the build of that energy and the, there's something about riding that wave, you know, that mm-hmm. is a part of what makes the Roots, you know, like we, you know, the people are dying for to get an applause in edgewise. yeah. And then, you know, yeah, when you finally give it to them, it's like, you know, the applause lasts for an hour. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, yeah. I'll take that. You know, I appreciate the feverishness of sort of just driving through a performance. And I think it may have been something that, you know, we developed. It's a trait that we developed in our days of just being a support act. You know what I mean? Having to go mm-hmm. on, you know, to rock with somebody while fans were still filing into their seats. You know what I mean? It's still yeah. daylight. Mm-hmm. The house lights aren't, you know what I mean? There's no spotlight on stage or anything yet.
Nobody's paying attention.
You know,
attention.
How are you going to hold folks' attention? And you, mm-hmm. once you get them, you don't want to set them back into place and let them clap and then have to engage them again. So I think there's something that we acquired in that is just a warrior level of pushing through a set, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it, you know, I think it began as competitiveness, you know, just wanting to make ourselves as hard an act of an act to follow as possible.
yeah.
But yeah, now it's just what we do.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we could talk to you forever, Tariq, but at some point you got to go to work. We love to have our guests play the Desert Island Jukebox game, you know, where you choose a track you can't live without. I want to confine the question a little bit. You write about how central that old piece of furniture that had a radio, an 8-track player, and a record, you know, everybody yeah. had one of these when they were, yeah. you know, our age, right?
Yeah.
Back then, 6, 7, 8. It was a freaking piece of furniture, almost as big as the refrigerator.
right.
And your mom had it on 24/7. Always. Whether they were guests or she was always playing the hi-fi, you write.
Yes.
Talk about something you remember her playing from then. Because you don't give us any music then. You give us lots and lots later with grandma and in school yeah. and on the streets, but not really early.
My mother would play lots of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Mm. She would play, I remember she was a huge George Benson fan. She played lots of George Benson.
Cause that's music in the air and lots of loving everywhere. So give me the night.
Stevie Wonder was, you know, I mean, it, you know what I'm saying? That was played, you know, at every turn. There was lots of Stevie Wonder, lots of the Jacksons. And, you know, this was when, you know, a young Michael Jackson was still sort of evolving. But, you know, I was a huge fan of the Jackson 5 and just the Jacksons family. Like my first, the first concert that I went to was the Fresh Festival. But then my second concert experience was the Jacksons Victory Tour. And, you know, just equally as impactful, you know, but for different reasons. But I remember all that stuff, and that those were the pieces of vinyl that she would play. She loved Luther Vandross. She would play lots of Luther Vandross records, later, you know what I mean, in the mid 80s and stuff. But those eight tracks of, the greatest hits of all the doo-wop songs, and then all the, all the songs they would play on, like, Happy Days, you know what I mean? stuff like that really resonated with me. I was, I watched, Sha-Na-Na, so I was a big fan of, like, Bowser. And, I was just a fan of vocal range. So any sort of doo-wop harmony thing where somebody had to sing really low, I thought it was dope, you know what I mean? The Oak Ridge Boys, when they sing, Giddy Up, Boom, Papa Mama, that bass dude, you know what I'm saying? So that stuff, those, like, those are some of my earliest memories, and that was music my mom had on 8-track. She would get the those Time Life, mail order, all of the greatest hits roll up the screen. She was a sucker for those, and that was my earliest influence. So, like, the first song I recall singing was the Duke of Earl. You know what I mean? Duke of Earl, Charlie Brown, that's the first stuff that I would perform, long before I was, I started writing raps.
Wow. Gene Chandler, we had him on the show.
We had Gene Chandler on the show. What an honor.
That's the Duke of Earl, man.
Very cool, man. Very cool.
You got to be number two to him. That's the coolest human being we've ever interviewed, right?
Dope. I'll take it.
Tariq Trotter, he makes music, but man, what an author. The Upcycled Self, a memoir on the art of becoming who we are. Man, what an honor to have you on Sound Opinions. Thank you.
Thank you. What a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you all. This has been great.
Well, Greg, we could have gone on forever, but that wraps up this conversation with Black Thought. As always, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your thoughts. Mr. Cott, what is on the show next week?
Jim, get that bell ready. Brian Eno. We are going to devote a good chunk of next week's show to an album, a classic album dissection of Brian Eno's Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy.
I want it on the record right from this moment that this was a suggestion from our producers and our listeners, not me. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions, as always, is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Max Hatlam, one of the only members of Team Sound Ops who isn't sick this week. And our social media consultant is Katie Cott.